Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What shared interests are at the heart of the bond between the United States and South Africa, and how has the relationship changed in recent years? Since the transition to majority-rule democracy in 1994, South Africa has continued to strengthen its infrastructure and telecommunications connectivity, grown its economy, and taken an ever-growing role in cultivating prosperity throughout the African continent. Leaders consider last year's World Cup soccer tournament in Johannesburg a major step forward in demonstrating those strengths to global business investors and tourists, but there are daunting challenges remaining, including economic disparity, a shortage of adequate schools, and the scourge of HIV/AIDS infections that affect nearly 18% of the adult population and contribute to a life expectancy of just 49 years. His Excellency Ibrahim Rasool is South Africa's ambassador to the United States. He's in town to speak at 6:30 this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, and his visit to North Texas, of course, happens to coincide with the First Lady's trip to South Africa and Botswana this week. Ambassador Rasool, welcome to Think.
No, thanks very much, Chris, and I'm very happy to be on Think.
Well, talk about the significance of the First Lady making her first major solo trip to your country.
It is an absolute honor for South Africa to have the First Lady there. It was as much an honor a few years ago when I was governor of the Western Cape to be informed that the then president's daughter was going to spend an internship at one of the hospitals in Cape Town. And so somehow we feel very blessed that the highest ranking Americans or U.S. citizens would trust their families with us. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing it affirms is that we are trusted with the first family. That secondly, they find it an important place to send their children to not simply be educated in skills, but to be educated in the ways of humanity. Because I think that that is what South Africa strives to be in the world, a model of a different humanity that comes from deep philosophical roots in the African continent of Ubuntu, a unique notion of interdependence. And that, I think, is where we believe that we make a difference in the world. That's our power in the world. And for Michelle and the two children to be traveling through South Africa, I just spoke to our people back home. They're at this moment in the Apartheid Museum, going through the history of how systematically South Africans have been discriminated against, dispossessed, the sacrifices that were made, but also the triumph of reconciliation, the triumph of peace, the triumph of justice, and the ability to have former enemies actually come together and share government. So that's what they're experiencing currently. And wherever they're going, they are facing logistical challenge, not security challenges, because the love is there. I think the logistical challenge is how do you hold the crowds back who see Michelle Obama as a superstar in her own right. So that's the delicious problems we have in South Africa.
So one of the focuses of Mrs. Obama's trip is on youth. And certainly there is a brighter future than ever for the young people of South Africa. But you yourself have acknowledged the fact that there is a shortage of really good schools available. Can you talk about what progress has been made and what sort of stands in the way of changing that?
You know, in South Africa, we really don't have a problem of, say, school infrastructure. We have chased for the last 17 years certain quantitative goals, like getting every child into a school, establishing further education and training colleges to give people skills, rationalizing our universities into 21 really great universities on the African continent. So we've gotten our quantitative goals sorted out. Our challenge is the quality of education that occurs. Now, if you can imagine that under the apartheid system, if you were black, you were not allowed to learn maths, science, engineering, business, or management. It was illegal for you to want to learn that in a public school. If you were colored, and that is the in-between group between black and white, you could do things that could make you a teacher, things that could make you a priest, things that could make you a lawyer. But nothing beyond that, no science for you. If you were white, you could do whatever you wanted to, and you'd come out with an education where Oxford University or Yale or Harvard would stand in line to have you. Now, if you can imagine that blacks did not have the opportunity even to become numerate, then you begin to understand how it takes 12 years for an education system to begin to reform itself.
Mm-hmm.
If you then understand that it did not even then have the sufficient supply of teachers to begin teaching those subjects, then you've got to go 12 years forward, because you first have to graduate the teachers who will teach the next generation, and then only the next generation. So we are looking on that kind of trajectory. We should be seeing these problems becoming solved closer to 2030 rather than in the immediate future.
So in the United States today, there are 30,000 people from the continent of Africa studying, not just South Africa, studying in this country. There are 10,000 Americans in the continent of Africa studying. What's the value of those exchanges?
Those exchanges are invaluable because they give us an accelerator effect. Because what our system will take a long while to get through in order to make those transformations, sending them on scholarships to the United States gives us the ability instantly to get the maths, the science, the engineering, the management, and all of those other skills, the health skills, into a group of people. Sometimes we have a challenge because they come here, they fall in love, and they love the freedom that they have in America. They love the convenience of living in America, and we have a job to get them back.
You want them back home.
Get them back to Africa. So those are challenges that we do face, but I think that more than those who stay are those who come back and make that kind of difference. In fact, I think that the African promise as a whole is being kept simply because we are getting back skilled managers, skilled health professionals, skilled engineers from the African diaspora, and we're getting them back working the African continent, including South Africa.
Do you find that as ambassador to the United States of South Africa, you are in some ways an ambassador for the entire continent?
That, unfortunately, is going to be the responsibility of a South African ambassador. Mm-hmm. I think South Africa represents for many Americans a soft landing. It's the known part of Africa. The World Cup has enormously changed perceptions. And can you imagine? The greatest number of visitors during the World Cup were not from England, were not from your traditional soccer-playing nations like Brazil. It was from the USA. They bought the most tickets for the World Cup, and they spent the most.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very conflicted when they played against Ghana, because we knew that if the US exited the tournament at that stage, the spending would significantly go down. But the point that I'm making is that South Africa is known. There's a human affinity with South Africans because so many Americans had sympathized and empathized with the struggle for freedom against apartheid in South Africa. And Nelson Mandela is a revered figure in the United States of America. So in a sense, we have to use that advantage not only to advance South Africa, but to advance the African continent. More than that, we have learned that there are some very important decision-making Americans who are sometimes geographically challenged. They don't understand the relationship between South Africa and, say, Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand that it is a continent apart. And when they hear something terrible happening in Sudan, they divest in South Africa. And so we have an opportunity to, or we have the responsibility to ensure that we represent the continent, and that we make sure that the continent gets its house in order, because we are all in one boat and we have to swim together or we'll sink together. And so we have to play that role.
I have to tell you, as an American, it's a little bit embarrassing to think that there are Americans making financial decisions about investments in the continent of Africa who don't recognize the distinction between the many states that are there. I mean, is it something that you have to sort of roll your eyes at? Or, you know, you talk very patiently about educating Americans about this, and it's a pretty simple fact of geography and world politics.
Look, it's not something that you can be that you can be impatient about. We don't have a kind of Hollywood that if a skyline comes up, you can guess which part of it's New York or it's Washington mm-hmm. or whatever. We don't have that kind of cultural impact on the world. And so our knowledge of America should not create the expectation that Americans' knowledge of Africa should be similar. And so our job is to seduce the USA into a love affair with Africa. And so rolling our eyes and all of those kind of things is not going to be helpful. I think we've just simply got to get on mm-hmm. with a job of putting perspectives in place, educating, and making sure that we are coherent in our case and that we are credible and plausible in the way in which we put the African case forward in the USA.
And how does it work in terms, or how has it been working in terms of U.S. investment in South Africa, then sort of thriving and then pushing out to other countries in the African continent?
I think that South Africa sees itself as a platform and a gateway for investment into sub-Saharan Africa. We know that it's a difficult thing for someone who is the head of an investment company in the USA being able to just go into a country like Congo and say, I want to invest here. I think that what South Africa represents is that soft landing. It represents a place where you can get 24/7 banking. It's a place where the rule of law is firmly entrenched. It's a place where all the institutions of a democracy are in place. The banking system is of the best in the world. And there is connectivity that is faster sometimes than you can find in the USA. And it's both internet connectivity as well as telephonic and mobile connectivity from South Africa all over. So in a sense, we have to then take up that responsibility to say to people, come to South Africa and your entry into sub-Saharan Africa is then through this relatively stable and prospering country called South Africa. It's the place where you can find partners. It's the place where you can do due diligence. It's the place where you can do the transaction and have it overseen legally, and you can do the financial banking transactions as well in South Africa as you move into sub-Saharan Africa. So, and the fact of the matter is that it's beginning to work. It's a hard sell. Americans at this moment are bruised. They've come through a hell of a period with the recession. We have gotten used to 30% unemployment rates. Americans are reeling from 10%, 9.2%. They're watching every movement of that dial. We sometimes wonder, what's the fuss when you're sitting with 30%, 40% unemployment rates in Africa? But we know that the American psyche has been made a little bit more defensive, a little bit more risk-averse, and they're going to take their time. Our proposition is a very simple one. The proposition is that Africa holds the promise of kickstarting the American economy back into life. All the empirical evidence is in our favor, and I really think that my mission is education and courage building towards the end of not only benefiting Africa, but benefiting the U.S. economy fundamentally over the next decade.
My guest this hour is His Excellency Ibrahim Rasool. He is Ambassador of South Africa to the United States. He's in town to speak tonight at 6:30 to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ambassador of South Africa to the United States, His Excellency Ibrahim Rasool. He's in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. When you talk, Ambassador Rasool, about 20 to 30% unemployment or 30 to 40% unemployment, I mean, you're right. In this country, those numbers are that takes us back to the time of the Great Depression. Who is it that is having trouble finding employment right now? Is it people who were not educated properly under the old apartheid system?
In South Africa, we often wonder whether we have an unemployment problem or an unemployability problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest that we have a problem of unemployability. If you connect this answer with the one I gave earlier about the education system, you can begin to understand that you are having people who've come out of school but are functionally not prepared for the kind of knowledge economy jobs that are developing in South Africa. If you can imagine that all the C-class Mercedes-Benzes that drive around in the USA would have been produced in South Africa, that all the right-hand drive BMWs for the world, 3-series BMWs, are produced in South Africa, that Ford has just opened a plant in South Africa to produce worldwide panel vans for the world market, then you begin to understand that there's a sophistication in the South African economy and a diversity in the South African economy that requires a particular skilled young person, but the education system has not yet met the challenge of producing those kind of skills. So we have an unemployability problem and, in fact, have an undersupply of applicants for skilled jobs. And so that really is the challenge, and it's a very dangerous challenge because you are sitting with young people who have the expectation of freedom, of equality and of opportunity, but are functionally unskilled to take those opportunities. And so you need to be able to manage their aspirations and so forth. So South Africa has a dual system by which it manages this tension in society. The one system is to pick up as many skilled people as possible in the economy, and the economy is growing. Prior to the recession, it was growing at in excess of 5%. It's now down to about 3% because of the recession. So we try to absorb as much labor as possible. And at the same time, we have what we call a safety net. And this safety net prevents the bottom of the world falling out of those who find themselves outside of the economy. And so when you get over the age of 60, there's a pension that awaits you. When you are you qualify, there's a public health system that picks up people with various diseases and illnesses, and particularly pediatric care is free in South Africa. There's a school feeding scheme that makes sure that children stay in school because they get a meal every day while they are at school. There's a disability grant that people access if they have a debilitating illness that takes them out of the marketplace. So we try to manage a burgeoning, growing economy and absorbing people, but those who can't be absorbed by virtue of age, disability, or youth and so forth, we create the safety net for them, because I think that the tension could be unbearable, especially if you consider that our tension is also color-coded. In South Africa, if you are white, by and large, you will be skilled to be absorbed into the economy. You can pick your career. If you are black, by and large, you could be unemployed. And so when you have this stark color-coded tension in society, you've got to remove the harsh ends of that standoff, because it could lead to social instability.
Well, to that extent, it certainly reminds us of what we've seen in this country, and it's getting better, but of course we continue to have racial tension in this country. It's one thing to say that every human being has equal rights under the law, and it's another thing to sort of change the way people feel about each other after this long history of subjugation. Do South Africans look at any of the patterns of the U.S. struggle for civil rights and apply it to what's taking place there?
I think, of course, we've been very fortunate in the sense that there's a golden triangle in the world of how to resolve great political struggles. It's Mahatma Gandhi, it's Martin Luther King, and it's someone like Nelson Mandela. And all three of them had one thing in common, and that is that their default position wasn't violence. Their default position was peace. Their default position was reconciliation. Their default position was compromise and negotiation. So I think to a large extent we are the beneficiaries of three great people who have traversed the earth. Having said that, I think that we have learned a lot from the way in which someone like Dr. King would have conducted his struggle, with dignity being the most apparent virtue in it. We all sang, "We Shall Overcome." We all sang, "Freedom Isn't Free." All of those kind of things. So at that level, there's an affinity. I think that there's one fundamental difference in that in South Africa, the black community is the majority, the overwhelming majority. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you are faced with a situation where it is the majority who can't find work, who are poverty-stricken, who are homeless, and who are disease-ridden. Sometimes you can make allowances for when a minority community experiences that. But having said that, I think that we look at the thoughtful application of affirmative action, that I think that some of which we have learned from the US and some of which I think that we have homegrown. I think that we certainly look at a U.S. economic model for how to move forward. But most importantly, I think that we, in stressful times, we look at how the U.S. has turned its diversity into the engine of its creativity and innovation. We've learned one important lesson. If you compare the U.S. with, say, some other societies, the lesson is that monocultures decay and lose their creative edge. It's multicultures that thrive and that becomes the engine of innovation and creativity. It is not to suppress the differences amongst people. And if you look at the U.S. Industrial Revolution and now the knowledge revolution that it is going through, it is precisely because you've got all these different genes that collide all the time and that bring different perspectives, different ideas, different ways of seeing things and paradigms to play, that the synthesis is always towards a higher goal. Monocultures don't have that. And so, in a sense, that for me is probably the most fascinating take back that I have from the USA. It's how to harness this diversity, take it away from its tendency towards destructiveness, and harness it in ways that it becomes the engine of innovation in a country like South Africa.
When you talk about the strength of diversity, how is South Africa coping with the influx of immigrants from other countries within sub-Saharan Africa looking for greater economic opportunity in South Africa? And I know many are going to Botswana as well.
I must say that I was shocked the other day when I looked at the statistic that South Africa has overtaken the USA as the number one destination for migration for the last 2 years. And that says that we're becoming the magnet for young people seeking opportunity from across sub-Saharan Africa. We're becoming the place of refuge for those who find themselves in trouble in places like Somalia, places like Zimbabwe, and places like Sudan and Congo. And so, in a sense, the wherewithal is there for the great American experience to be transplanted onto the African soil. And that is where my attempt at actively reading America's coping mechanisms and changing problems into opportunities becomes an important part of my work as an ambassador. So in a sense, I think we've got to continue managing this diversity. We had a most unfortunate outbreak in 2008 of what we call xenophobic violence. It is when you've got too many people competing for scarce resources, when the one is the other, the alien, the incomer, and your indigenous population feels that they are removing opportunities from them, whether they're skilled to take up those opportunities or not, or whether they are humble enough to take up the meager opportunities, those rational things get lost in the debate. But we've had a very unfortunate outbreak of that kind of violence. But it's been a very important learning lesson for us. We've had to then ask ourselves, how do we manage this diversity? How do we create the basis and of inclusivity as the fundamental value in our from our constitution? The one aspect where we differ with the US, constitutionally speaking, is that the US puts a premium, and it's dangerous saying this to you as a journalist, but the US puts a premium on freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. South Africa enshrines freedom of expression, but subjects it to the right to dignity.
So hate speech has been a major issue.
So hate speech is a major issue in South Africa. You can say whatever you want to, but you can't indignify someone else. And that really is where, and so now we've had regulations to begin to describe what is hate speech, so that we can all exercise the freedom to expression in ways. And that is where the media and journalists and all of them have entered this debate. And it's a real dialectical tension in our society between where dignity starts and ends and where freedom of expression starts and ends. But having said that, I think that that managing diversity is important. We, for example, have 11 official languages. We err on the side of inclusivity. We manage it very well. Everyone has the right to speak their language and to be spoken to in their language, particularly in important public fora like parliament, like the courts, like a police station, et cetera, because then you flee into your mother tongue and you should be heard.
Well, let me ask you this. I know that your faith has been a big part of the thing that drives your political activism and your social activism and has been for some time. You are a Muslim, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah,
yeah, and that's 1.7% of the population. Has that been a hindrance for you at all, politically or professionally, or is freedom of religion completely to be taken for granted?
You see, our freedom of religion goes to the point where we would say that all religions are equal. It's not number. There is no state religion. We're a secular society.
Right.
But we are a secular society mindful of the fact that much of the moral impetus in the struggle against apartheid came from the religious convictions of our people. And we are finding ways to harness the value-based ways in which religions have inspired us, and how do you retain those values as we go forward? So we don't build a Chinese wall between state and religion. We create enough porousness in that wall so that the values of religion, the best values of religion, can infuse into our public life. But the tendency of religions to want to theocratize society are checked, because that's not what we're about. And so I've become a little bit of a phenomenon in the Muslim world, because how did you win an election to become the governor of a province that has 90% Christians in it? And it's just simply the maturity of our society. They simply want someone who they can recognize as a good person, and they will elect you. And that, I think, is really, how did it happen that Nelson Mandela appointed 7 Muslims to his cabinet? How did the first Chief Justice, who is the equivalent of your Chief Justice, how did that one manage to be a Muslim? It's simply because I think that our equality is a lived equality. We don't make it an issue. And because we have the dignity issues, you can't even allude to something being a disqualifier if you don't have proof of wrongdoing. And so you can't theoretically speak about something being a disqualifier. You've got to come and you've got to say, what has the person done wrong? And that, I think, is where the right to dignity comes in. But having said that, it has placed enormous responsibilities on me to speak back to a Muslim world that is fundamentally in trouble. I was leader of the African National Congress in the Western Cape and then became premier at a time when there were groups of Muslims in Cape Town who were hell-bent on unleashing an urban terror fundamentalist campaign because they were against abortion, because they were against gay marriages, because they were against alcohol and all of those things. They thought they had the right to live out their religion by bombing alcohol outlets, bombing Jewish synagogues, bombing tourist facilities, and killing people. And that was going to be my biggest test. Would I be able to be as firm with them as I would have been? We were firm, but we were smart. Because I understood the nature of this fundamentalist beast, an extremist beast that I was confronting, and because I was an insider to much of that kind of thinking, we understood that we needed to do things differently. We never declared a state of emergency in a context of urban terror. We did not fight the fight against them on their preferred terrain, which was with guns and bombs. Mm-hmm. We did not do the counter-instinctive. We did not isolate them from their society. We, in fact, got the biggest courtrooms and invited as many people who could come and media to come and report on these cases. And when the Muslim community heard what was done in their name, when these bombers had to explain why they justified killing that little girl, and they spoke about crossfire, their credibility just completely went away. So sometimes the counter-instinctive that you do is the way in which you fortify your community against those. And that's the lesson that I think we need to be able to give to the world, but mostly to the Muslim community. You cannot demand from others what you don't give yourself. You've got to be able to secure the rights of others to secure the rights that you want for yourself. And that, I think, is fundamentally the anti-extremist agenda that I think South Africa adds to its armory in dealing with troubled spots in the world.
My guest this hour is His Excellency Ibrahim Rasool, Ambassador of South Africa to the United States. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is His Excellency Ibrahim Rasool, Ambassador of South Africa to the United States, in town to speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372, and we'll speak with John in Denton. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris. I've just spent the last 45 minutes listening to the Ambassador paint a picture of South Africa, which I think we would all like to see was correct. But, you know, Chris, we have a saying here in Texas, when something doesn't make sense, that dog won't hunt. And so I guess I have to ask the ambassador, given what he said over the last 45 minutes, how come Robert Mugabe is still in Rhodesia? And the South African government is subsidizing what he's doing.
Well, let's get a response to that.
No, thanks very much. John, I'm not sure who's the dog, but the issue of Mugabe, and we don't call it Rhodesia anymore, we call it Zimbabwe, is a very important one. I think that if you take the picture as a whole, if you were phoning in 2 years ago, you'd be able to point to 16 to 20 conflicts on the African continent. I think the fact that we now speak of about 4 is a remarkable sea change in the way in which we're dealing with some of those matters. We would love to go out and condemn any dictator, including Robert Mugabe, pull out the megaphone, do whatever needs to be done. But the fact of the matter is that we have a little bit more of a responsibility to solve the situation as opposed to give expression to our moral outrage. And so systematically, I think we have been working. We've moved from a one-party state to a shared government of unity, and we are preparing for the election that will then finally decide what happens in between. What we have done is to say, how do we divide up the power basis in a place like Zimbabwe, in which Mr. Mugabe, as president, has sway over the army, and Mr. Tsvangirai, as MDC leader and as prime minister, now has sway over the police. And I think what we've created is a situation of equilibrium as opposed to the total power that would have resided in one. I think that what we needed to do was to start stabilizing that economy in Zimbabwe, because South Africa has 5 million Zimbabweans in South Africa itself. That and if that's the subsidy you're speaking about, then it is a subsidy of looking after refugees that have escaped the trauma, 5 million of them in South Africa. And so certainly I think that we need to lay the table for a free and fair election, which will happen. That secondly, that we need to create a situation in which the outcome of that election is respected, and that whoever wins will become the government. If we had spoken about this 3 years ago, you could have been skeptical. But I think that there is difficult, sometimes dangerous progress on the road to a solution. But we think that it is infinitely better than it would have been 3 years ago. And in much the same way, I think that there's vindication of the same strategy in a place like Sudan. There are some rough points, but we applied exactly the same logic to that situation at a time when the world wanted Omar Bashir hanged for war crimes. We have been able to get him to preside over not only a referendum, but a secession that will happen on the 9th of July. So I think that we're applying a different logic to problem solving. For those who are impatient, it looks like mollycoddling. I think certainly, unlike many other conflicts in the world, we see the exit. We can sign off on the exit, and it's a 3-year exit rather than a 10-year protracted war that we get engaged in.
Can you also foresee the end of the terrible scourge of HIV and AIDS, particularly within South Africa, which has a higher infection rate than many other countries in sub-Saharan Africa?
I think it's too early to pronounce the end of HIV. We are approaching the plateau. And that's a very important bit of terminology in the fight against HIV, because the infection rates climb, and you hope to reach a plateau, and then it starts tapering off. South Africa has one of the most extensive treatment regimes anywhere in the world. And that's acknowledged by the World Health Organization, UNAIDS, everyone. The way in which we're doing it is phenomenal. I think what we've added to our arsenal is, on the one hand, some groundbreaking research to insert the antiretrovirals into a microbicide gel that for the first time transfers the power over HIV to women. So women would apply that to themselves, and before the HIV virus can even enter the body, it is killed on contact. And that is a phenomenal breakthrough. It's already at 40% efficacy. Once it reaches 70% efficacy over the next few months, we will put it to market. And we think that that will be important. Great work is being done on a vaccine, and we're hoping that that will be a success that South Africa could announce to the world in partnership with many American companies. So the plateau is in sight. The treatment regime is there. The research agenda is being driven relentlessly. And I believe that the plateau is a year or two away.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Gadi in Dallas. Hi, Gadi.
Hello, this is Gadi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you, Terry, for taking my call. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for making yourself available for this call. The question that I have, I think recently there was an article in the New York Times that spoke about the issue of xenophobia in South Africa. I believe that the South African government has not adequately addressed this, because the South African indigents are clearly, you know, targeting non-South Africans, and you know, where people are being laced with tire and set on fire. That is very concerning, especially with a country as large as South Africa. I would like you to comment specifically on what the government of South Africa is doing to address this very serious issue. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thanks very much, Gadi, for that question. I want to say that that certainly the hiatus of those attacks was in 2008. I think we've had threats and we've had isolated incidents since then, but by and large, what we have been able to do is to quell those attacks on foreigners. I would not claim that there's an absence of tension. I would not claim that there's an absence of competition for scarce resources, and I would not claim that there's an absence of conflict from time to time. I believe that the program that South Africa has sought since then is a program of reintegration, and it is not where we put refugees or people of foreign origin in camps. It's really where we integrate them into communities, protect their businesses, and this is unusual. We give them the same welfare rights that we give to our own citizens. They do qualify for grants, they do qualify for pensions, for free healthcare, and for schooling. And that really is going far beyond what many others would ordinarily be able to do. So I think that the adequacy of the South African government's response remains a matter of subjective evaluation. We can all have an idea of what is adequate. I can simply say what it is that we have done, and you be the judge of the adequacy thereof.
When you talk about competition for scarce resources, we think about things like food and water. In 2007, there was a crisis with electricity. Can you talk about the progress that has been made to ensure that there is enough power to do the things, not only for individuals, but for business growth that South Africa needs?
You know, South Africa under apartheid had a nuclear power station. It had tens and tens of coal-fired power stations, and it had access to the Cahora Bassa hydroelectric plant. We had an oversupply of energy, and the only reason we had an oversupply of energy was because 80% of the population did not have energy, and the economy was growing at a negative rate.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, electricity was very, very cheap. We almost gave it away. Post-apartheid, we have the same infrastructure, but we now have 80% of the people connected to the grid, and we have an economy growing at 5%, and we are having to export energy to our neighboring states to keep their factories and their people connected. We now have an energy infrastructure program that that builds more power stations, that feeds a growing economy, and that improves exports to our neighbors in a great way. Last month, the United States Export-Import Bank made a phenomenal decision to fund the second major power station in South Africa. With all the energy that it will give, it's carbon capture, meaning that the carbons are not released into the air. It's carbon storage. It stores it underground and then degrades it.
This is a coal-fired plant?
It's coal-fired, mm-hmm. but with all the kind of modcons on that reduces its impact on the environment, while at the same time, 20% of our energy will be from renewable sources. So we are addressing the infrastructure program. The difficulty in South Africa is that when you've paid 10 cents per unit for energy, the cost of that energy is at $1 per unit. How do you move rapidly from 10 cents that people used to pay as a tariff to $1 per unit? And we've had to do that over 10 years. 2 years ago, for the first time, the cost of energy was met by the tariff. And only now that we are moving beyond the tariff is there room for private investment in the energy field. And that is where I think we are beginning to speak to U.S. People, both in the conventional energy source field as well as in the renewable energy source field, to say that we have restructured our tariffs in a way that now makes it profitable to come and invest in energy, and we will include that energy onto the grid in order for you to be able. So those have been the kind of constraints that we faced, but the story is really good news, and as a result, you are going to find American companies, as a result of the Exim Bank loan, you are going to find American companies being at the forefront of being able to benefit from the surge in providing energy infrastructure.
We have spoken for most of this hour, Ambassador Rasool, about very serious and important things, but South Africa is also a major tourist destination and one that really interests Americans. As you mentioned, a lot of Americans got their first visit to the country last year during the World Cup, but talk about some of the things that, you would like to boast about in terms of people coming to visit. What do you want Americans to come see?
Look, I think I come from Cape Town, so I'm quite biased. Mm-hmm. I think, by and large, Americans are surprised by the level of infrastructure and connectivity. So just arriving there and seeing these spaghetti highways, being able to reach any other place in South Africa within 2 hours by aeroplane and regular aeroplanes and great quality food on the aeroplanes and so forth, I think is already a revelation. We all know that Africa, but also South Africa, is the custodian of some of the world's most rare animals that you can find. I had a minister of state from Turkey coming to visit. We were going to have an official dinner for him the evening, and he wanted to see the Western Cape. He came back that night and said, I'm not speaking about trade. I want to speak about the fact that I believe that when God decided on paradise, he must have seen the Western Cape. Because he said, I flew by helicopter over the Atlantic Ocean, and I saw hundreds of dolphins swimming. I landed at Hansby, got into a wetsuit, went down in a shark cage, and I could touch the snouts of 10 sharks around me. And then went to lunch at Hermanus, sat in a cave having my lunch, and 20 meters away from me were 5 whales frolicking.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but you've certainly whet our appetites. Thank you so much. My guest this hour is His Excellency Ibrahim Rasool, South Africa's ambassador to the U.S. He'll speak tonight at 6:30 to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
No, it's been a great pleasure, Chris, and I think you live up to everything that the World Affairs Council has told me about your reputation.
It's very
kind. Thank you very
much. Thank you. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.